This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. You hear weekdays from noon to 1 on WGN Radio. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. It's 12:11. Lots of ground to cover, as always, today. We'll start with just kind of an overview of the markets and a little bit about real estate with Lise Glink, who joins us regularly. You can go to Think Glink to think like Glink. Hi, Lise. How are you?
I'm good, John. Thank you. How are you?
You can use that if you want. It just kind of happened there.
I like it. I like it. Good marketing.
Speaking of the markets, so here again, the tech sector leads the way today. It's the Dow down, but the other indices are up.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We've got NASDAQ that's reaching towards new highs again. It's up 170 points, which is pretty significant, while the Dow is down, and that just shows us that tech is booming and continues to boom.
And also, if you don't mind, a little bit about the real estate market. What is happening there in the Chicago area, maybe nationwide as well?
Well, I think sellers are probably pretty happy because if you look at what's been going on, there are not nearly enough homes available for sale. We have mortgage interest rates at a new all-time low, below 3% for a 30-year fixed-rate loan, which means if you're going for a 15-year or a 10-year, you might be able to get even under 2.5% for that mortgage. And that's driving buyers to really get out there and snap up all sorts of homes. We're seeing it in the North Shore and the western suburbs particularly, which is interesting because those were areas that really lagged over the last 10 to 12 years.
So you've got motivated buyers, and you have a tight inventory, so the sellers see them coming. I know of several instances, family, friends, just anecdotally, where the bidding starts at the asking price and it goes up from there.
That's right. I mean, people are really, really happy if they're sellers because what we've seen over the last 10 years, 10 years ago in the recession, Chicago metropolitan area lost around a third of its value, of its home values. People were selling for far less than they had bought for in the mid-aughts, like 2005 and 2006. And while all the other metro areas really around the country zoomed up and their home values recovered, ours really didn't. They just sort of slowly plodded along. And even up earlier this year, in January, December, people were selling homes for, you know, a lot less than they'd even paid for them 20 years ago. So no price appreciation, and now we're starting to see that reverse a little bit, where people are, if not making money on their homes, at least they're not selling for huge losses.
This is my idea. I want you to tell people how to get your book. Then we'll take a break, and we'll come back and talk about some other market news. But you've got a pretty good book out, and if you know somebody who's looking to buy a house, this is a – I literally I think I owe you $20, but you were kind enough to send me your latest copy. But tell folks what the name of your book is.
It's called 100 Questions Every First-Time Home Buyer Should Ask. And truly, you can get it on Amazon faster than I can even get it into an envelope and send it to you. But what I did in this book, John, as you know, because now you've seen it, is I really went back through and re-looked at every part of the home buying experience. And it really is designed to help people who are particularly millennials and Gen Z, which now represent the largest portion of first-time home buyers, get through, navigate this process on a winning side.
Title of the book again is?
100 Questions Every First-Time Home Buyer Should Ask.
Let's talk about other things happening economically, personally, and big picture in just a minute. We're talking to Lise Glink. You can follow her at thinkglink.com. We just talked a little bit about real estate, and you were reminding us that the interest rates are low, the inventory is tight, so it is a seller's market right now.
It is.
Let's move on then. I wanted to ask you about this. There's a headline at CNBC today. Only 32% of companies, one-third, only one-third of companies returning to work have plans for employees' child care needs, as many schools are postponing the reopening full time. You're an employer. You thought you just had to make the new workplace safe. But what do you do if people have kids at home? How are you going to either accommodate the kids, I guess, in the office, Elise, or continue to enable your employees to work from home, huh?
Right. It's take your kids to work every day.
Century.
According to the U.S. Household Pulse survey, which they've been now doing a special survey every week of the 10 weeks since this whole thing started, 99.2% of all people in the U.S., of all households, have experienced a K-12 educational change. And if you layer on top of that the fact that most child care shops are closed, very few have reopened, particularly in some cases they're now closing again, the ones that did open up, and you realize that companies are facing a huge problem when it comes to trying to attract workers back if those workers don't have any place that's safe to put their children. Children are always going to come first.
Yeah.
And this is a big concern for everybody.
Well, I just worry that at some point, I think the business people, depending on your industry, need to get back into the office. You might be able to work efficiently from home to a degree, but if your children are there, then it's not the same work-at-home scenario that we would imagine. Something's got to give.
Right, but think about people who don't work in offices and, you know, are other kinds of workers. So factory workers, people who are in manufacturing, retail workers, people who don't have the option of working from home, they also don't have a place to put their kids. And in many cases, lower income workers, and by that I mean sort of the bottom half of any payroll is considered to be the low income half. Many of those people qualified for government-sponsored child care, or the government defrays it, but only if you put your children into accredited programs. Those programs are closing as well, and so if you find a different place, if you can find one that's open, it also has to be approved, or you don't get that government contribution to paying for child care. So this is really actually more of a multi-layered issue for parents who have different kinds of jobs.
I'm glad you said that because you're right. I'm thinking about offices and not factories, not retail workers. So are these businesses going to carve out some space to house the kids and hire a staff to care for them?
Well, that poses a whole different kind of issue, right? You can't have a child care facility at your local coffee shop, for example, or, you know, your manufacturing company may or may not be able to do that. Now, some companies are doing it, right? So Target has expanded its backup child care program, which is great. Their partner is a company called Bright Horizons, but they also temporarily closed half of their 700 child care centers. So the real story, John, is that this is a complex, layered problem that has several business components. One is for the workers themselves, and the other is the business of taking care of children in this country and how we're going to actually do that. And education is a big part of it for everybody over the age of, say, 6, because that's when kids start to go to school, either part-time for kindergarten or full-time sometimes. And then, of course, full day when they get into first grade.
Mark Cuban said something interesting. Don't get greedy about, I guess, the markets generally, because they do seem to be impervious to the bad news or the bad employment numbers. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, you hear, we've been hearing a lot about Robinhood, which is a relatively new trading platform, and it has sucked in all kinds of people who think they're going to get rich being day traders. And that's particularly something that we're seeing. Well, more and more of these new day traders have never experienced anything other than a bull market. And so what Mark Cuban said is that everyone is a genius in a bull market, right? I mean, the market goes up 32%, and if you get 32% or 42% or even 22% in your money, you feel so smart. But the reality is that this is completely disconnected. From reality, right? The success of the stock market right now, the Dow, which is the biggest, you know, hand-chosen components, right, just a handful of them really, or even NASDAQ, which looks at these stocks that are the Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, Now, these are companies that are just blowing it out of the water right now, and it's distorting the market and how people are thinking about it, which is not to say people aren't making money day trading. I just think it's a recipe for disaster, and so does he, because we have the Federal Reserve pushing liquidity. They've promised to basically give a loan to any company that wants one, and that's just not reality. And at some point in time, this will stop, and I just don't want people to get hurt.
What bull market is he referring to, the one since the election or that predated the election or the one since April?
I think he's asking, you know, I think what he's referring to is what's been going on since we've had the resurgence after the 30% drop.
Yeah.
He and many other experts are suggesting that there will be a second round of drop in the stock market. And if you hold on to your stocks, you know, eventually you'll be fine again. And maybe that's what everybody's going to do. But there will be some losers, and when they lose, they're going to lose big.
Are you hearing anything today about the stimulus for the next round of 600 or 400 or whatever that amount might be?
So the latest round the latest information that's coming out of D.C. right now is that even though the $600 extra per week is going to go away, and that's at the end of this week, by the way, on the 25th, I think, on Saturday, is that sort of the last check goes out. They are looking at a $200 per week option, which I think Mitch McConnell is hoping is more palatable to both sides, but also solves some problems. I will point out, though, that I think the only reason we aren't seeing more people or even more people take up the forbearance options that are available to them is that this $600 a week is letting everybody make their mortgage payments and rent payments. And I think that we're going to see that go. If it drops down to $200 a week, more and more people are going to be housing insecure, as they say. The nice way of saying maybe out of a place to live.
Well, what's the status of that? I thought that landlords were not supposed to evict people under the current circumstances.
That ends as well. So that moratorium is up in another few weeks. And that's only for people who had federally backed mortgages. Everybody else is, you know, of course, able to if their court systems have opened, which they haven't. You need the court to be able to start eviction proceedings. But we are seeing that about a third of people are very concerned about being able to make their rent payment for August 1st, and about a quarter of people are missing their rent payment still in July. And so that number hasn't gone down the way it had in prior months, which leads me to believe that more and more people are starting to be very nervous about it. In fact, when you look at that household survey I mentioned earlier, 49% of Americans, almost 50% of Americans have now lost employment income in their households, and another 30% expect to see that happen next month. So very concerning in the way of having enough income to just stay afloat during this thing.
At least the consensus, though, is, right, the president in both houses say that we should have more stimulus, but the debate is about how much, 600 or 200, is that where we are?
I think it's about that, and it's about the president seems to feel that a payroll tax would be helpful, but even members of his own party don't think that that's the case. And then there's some concern about the PPP, which was the support for small and medium-sized businesses. If you got one of those in mid-April or mid-May, you've run out of money by now, and so are you going to close? Are those people going to be unemployed? I think there's a big question about how people and companies stay afloat over the next few months.
And then there's Mayor Lori Lightfoot today announcing that come Friday, Chicago goes back to phase three, which doesn't shut down restaurants, but it does bars that don't serve food, and it limits the number of people you can serve at one table. So a big economic hit, I guess, generally speaking, to the food and beverage business in town.
Yeah, it doesn't help. But look at what's going on in Florida, where 100 hospitals are operating at 100% capacity for ICU, and they're putting people in the halls. Same thing is going on in parts of Texas. We're seeing it in Arizona, and now Nevada also having, and Southern California, tremendous amount of trouble keeping up with the numbers of people who are getting sick. So it's worrisome on both sides, and I feel for every business person. As a small business owner myself, I feel for you, and I just don't know what the answer is here unless we get rid of this or there's a vaccine.
And yet the markets keep betting on the future positively, don't they? I mean, it just seems to be nothing dissuades investors, maybe because there's no place else to put your money, but they're finding stocks and they are continuing to invest in it. And if your retirement is somehow tied to some index fund, there's some hope for people, at least on the mid-horizon, eh?
There are. Absolutely. If you're invested in the stock market, you're doing okay. Half of Americans don't have a dollar in the stock market, and those are the people I'm most worried about.
You can follow Elise Glink at thinkglink.com. She's the financial wellness expert. And one more time, Elise, I'm not pulling your leg here. I think it's a terrific book. What's the title of that book again?
Oh, John, you're very kind. 100 questions every first-time homebuyer should ask.
It's a busy market out there. It's a tricky one. Nice to talk to you, Elise. Thanks for your time.
You bet.
One quick note about the city of Chicago from the office of the mayor, this guidance on going back to phase three. I think one of the last points is one of the more critical ones. Residential property managers will be asked to limit guest entry to 5 per unit to avoid indoor gatherings and parties. It's another one of those things like self-quarantine if you come from an infected state. It's another one of those requests that will be impossible to manage. The police aren't going to know, and I don't know that they're going to go door to door. But this is directed at young people, I'm thinking, who would host parties, oblivious to the danger that's out there, maybe old people too. But residential property managers, the person in charge of your condo or your apartment building, are going to be asked to limit guest entry. You can't have more than 5 friends come up to your place to avoid indoor gatherings and parties. Remember, it's in the 19 to 29-year-old category that the COVID-19 has been spiking the most. So that's going to be a challenge for those residential property managers, but that's where the emphasis of this seems to be going, that and bars as well. On a phone line, Jim Dahlke joins us, the senior editor at Chicago Inno. Visit AmericanInno.com/Chicago. Hey, Jim, thanks for joining us. How are you today?
Hey, John, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
So last chance for you to go to that, big party you're going to go to is now through Thursday. Come Friday, they're going to nip it in the bud, sir.
Yeah, it's amazing that anyone is having large parties right now. it's kind of amazing that we're almost through July and people still haven't really gotten the news yet.
I know. I mean, right. Like, that's on you kids and you adults too, whoever's doing it. You brought this upon yourself and frankly all of us. So now we're kicking it back to phase three. Let's talk a little bit about things that are going on the innovation and tech side. COVID-19 slows Chicago venture funding in Q2. I'm reading your article at AmericanInno.com. I'm not surprised to read that. What can you tell me here?
Yeah, exactly. Not surprising, right? The coronavirus has had a pretty significant impact on venture capital, both nationally and certainly in Chicago. So just last quarter, Chicago companies raised about $364 million in venture capital, down about 22% from the previous quarter and over 40% from the same quarter of last year. That's in the amount of money raised. The number of deal volume also lower last quarter. 54 deals in Chicago last quarter. That's compared to 70 in the quarter before and 69 in the same quarter last year. So not surprising, the coronavirus has definitely taken a toll on Chicago startups in terms of the amount of money that they can raise. And, this is pretty much in step with conversations we've been having with venture capitalists across the city who say, hey, we're open for business, but our deal volume is going to be lower. We're going to be more critical of deals. We're going to be focusing on the portfolio companies that we currently have, the investments that we're currently making, making mm-hmm. sure that those businesses are strong and healthy, and we're going to be slower to make new investments. So something we're certainly seeing in Chicago nationally, the deal volume is down over 23%. So Chicago kind of right in line there with what we're seeing nationally.
Late last week, your Catherine Davis posted an article, too, about the likes of Ken Griffin and what they're doing. Catch me up on that.
Yeah, so Ken Griffin is among the investors in a new Chicago startup called Cohesion, and a really interesting software business. They are creating technology for building managers, so kind of focusing on Class A downtown office buildings, kind of creating a really centralized tech platform for a lot of interesting kind of communication and managing tools. So this is a startup that just raised $6.5 million. Griffin, Hyde Park Angels, and some others were in the investing round there. And what Cohesion basically does is they kind of create this platform for building managers that allows them to do things like distribute mobile key cards to their tenants, giving tenants easy ways to book amenities, make maintenance requests, kind of create a centralized platform for better communication and better service. And so it's actually a startup that was born out of a Chicago group called Environmental Systems Design. They manage 151 North Franklin in downtown Chicago. Actually, it's home to Facebook's local headquarters, and basically kind of built the technology in-house and then spun it out into its own venture. So the news last week being Cohesion raised a $6.5 million round.
I wonder if that's a pretty good little sector to be in right now. It seems to me like managing buildings and people is a pretty good idea right now.
Especially with getting companies back to the office, giving coronavirus. So they're able to track a lot of data on where people are within buildings, who has access to what rooms, who can get into certain spaces, and their technology is certainly coming in handy right now. They said that, you know, their business continues to be, you know, very active right now as building managers are getting back and looking for new tech tools to kind of make the transition back to the workplace a little more seamless.
A new sponsor here doesn't manufacture, but will install equipment that when I come into the building, it will look at my face. I guess it's a camera. It will tell what my temperature is. It will tell if I'm an approved person, and it will tell if I'm wearing a mask. And the employer could set all of the criteria, like, okay, we aren't going to worry about the mask, or we aren't going to worry about the person, but the whoever they are, they have to mask on. Anyway, you set the criteria, and then the door doesn't open up if they don't meet those. Mm-hmm. And it's not a human being. It's software that will regulate that. Fascinating, isn't it?
Pretty incredible, right? It's kind of hard to imagine that, you know, think back to 6, 7, 8 months ago that we could have never imagined that's what it takes to get into a building, right?
How about it? Yeah, nice to talk to you. Let's visit again next week. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, John.
That's Jim Dahlke, senior editor at Chicago Inno. Visit AmericanInno.com. By the way, that sponsor is Dr. Tech, D-R-T-E-C, no H on that, Dr. Tech. .net to find out more about that technology. Let's find out more about the Wintrust Business Minute with Ryan Burrow.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. This is the last week for the $600 federal lifeline for millions of unemployed Americans. The program doesn't technically expire until July 31st, but this is the last week that benefits will be paid. Americans will continue to get state unemployment benefits. Congress is working on a new stimulus package. Chicago-based United Airlines says it will now maximize airflow volume with high-efficiency particulate air filtration systems as flyers board and deplane as a way to reduce the spread of COVID-19. The airline says a combination of the HEPA filters, air conditioning, and pressurization system on board United's mainline aircraft recirculates air every 2 to 3 minutes and removes more than 99.9% of particles, including viruses and bacteria. Add Aldi to the list of retailers requiring customers to wear masks nationwide. Aldi, citing CDC regulations, says its policy goes into effect starting July 27th. Employees are required to wear masks. The grocery chain is also allowing customers to get delivery or curbside pickup at some locations. I'm Ryan Burrow, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Back to you, Jordan. What are you looking at?
Right now, the Dow is up, and it was down much of the day, but it is now up 26 points. S&P 500 is at 18 points up today, and the NASDAQ is up 188 points.
Orion Samuelson's looking at the agribusiness scene. Go ahead, O.
Okay, the numbers in the grain trade at the Chicago Board of Trade, wheat and corn under pressure today. Wheat down 14 and 3/4 cents a bushel, and September corn down 4.5 cents a bushel, but August soybeans are trading higher, up 5.75 cents. The livestock futures, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, a completely red screen there. August lean hog contract down $2.25 a hundredweight. August live cattle down $1.25, and August feeder cattle are down $1.22 a hundredweight. Weather continues to be ideal for the development of the crop. We'll get crop condition reports later this afternoon, but we're in the pollinating season for the corn crop, and we'll be moving into the maximum weather for soybean production in August, so we'll be looking for rains then. But so far, crop conditions are above what they were a year ago. For the state of Iowa, a major egg producer, Iowa egg producers who euthanized hens as a result of plummeting demand caused by the virus will be eligible for government payments to cover disposal costs, according to a state agency today. The Iowa Disposal Assistance Program has been paying pork producers $40 for each market-ready hog they have been forced to euthanize as a result of the supply chain disruptions. Thousands of hogs were killed statewide as processing plants slowed production in April and May due to the coronavirus outbreaks. And today, the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship said the program would be extended for another round of funding and expanded to benefit egg producers. The department said 70% of Iowa egg-laying hen flocks produce for the liquid market that serves restaurants and schools, and demand plummeted as a result of closures that started in March, and the price of liquid eggs dropped by 68%. And producers responded by reducing the size of their flocks. But egg producers will be eligible for 25 cents for each hen they euthanized and disposed of between April 1st and July 20th. And the meatpacking industry, which was severely impacted by the shutdown, two of the world's largest meat packers said Friday they have installed ultraviolet air cleaning equipment in some U.S. plants as pressure mounts on food companies to protect workers amid growing concerns about airborne transmission of the coronavirus. Plants owned by JBS, which is a Brazilian company, and Tyson Foods, which produces beef, pork, and chicken, said it's doing extensive research on airflow and testing ultraviolet air treatment systems across several plants, not yet known whether such technologies will kill the coronavirus. And that's your money on 720 WGN.
Kind of nice to have the White Sox minute back, isn't it? We talked, Bob Sirach did on his show this morning, and I sure did on my 9 to noon show, how much I was enjoying listening to Andy and DJ do the baseball game last night. The baseball game here on WGN. Sox beat the Cubs. Big controversy over what the final score was. 6-3 said the box score. Somebody texted in and said, hey, it was 6-3. For those of us wagering, that matters on over-unders and stuff. It was 7-3. Final score. Amy Guth, did you watch, listen to, or attend the game last night?
It just seemed also surreal to have baseball going. Suddenly there and filling our social media and being able to listen and watch and all that. It's a nice part of summer that glad that we can have it in some form.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. I mean, even if you don't care about baseball, even if you're not a sports person, it's an exhibition game. But it just was a measure of normalcy that I've missed, and I gotta say, it sure felt good listening to the game. Okay, back to the real world. Amy Guth on a phone line. Global air passenger slump continues, and they're projecting it now. They're not just telling us how bad it is. Now the experts are looking at what's going to happen in the near future, huh, Amy?
Yeah, that's right. So according to Moody's Investor Service, they've put out a report to talk about, like, what does this recovery look like for airlines and airports and manufacturers, right there directly connected to aviation. And that timeline is looking like it won't recover to pre-coronavirus levels until the end of 2023. What's interesting to me about that number is very early in this slump, when we saw airlines really quickly hitting this huge impact to, you know, the decline in travel,
some leadership from United said that probably mid-early March. That was a number that was already kind of going like, if this continues, it's not going to look good for us until 2023. And here comes Moody's saying, yeah, that's about right. So manufacturers, we're talking about Boeing and Airbus, but especially Boeing here based locally, who's had so many hurdles to overcome and is still working through them with the grounding of the 737 MAX. They're seeing carriers cancel orders, and they've really had a lot of impact there. So, you know, this is really taking a look at the scope of that. And as you and I have talked about, we have this kind of big question mark October 1st when federal funding runs out for airlines. We're looking at tens of thousands, possibly over hundreds of thousands, of airline workers suddenly unemployed. Adding into that how people feel about travel, what travel numbers will look like, all that. Moody's factored all that in this report. And that the end of 2023 was the number they came up with, which doesn't necessarily mean that in 2022 being on a plane won't feel kind of normal. It won't necessarily feel like it does now where it's relatively empty and we're seeing, you know, numbers that got down into the single digits for occupancy and for travel numbers. But to get right back to that big 2019 pre-pandemic level, they're really looking at this in a long-term way.
Steve Grzanich mentioned this story earlier today, but it bears repeating. The coin shortage is real, isn't it?
Yeah, I think this is so interesting. And so as we had these shutdowns in parts of the economy, including the mint, but also as people were maybe not paying with cash, they were using cards only, things like that, as people were not shopping in physical stores, the coin shortage is real. So there is a bank in Wisconsin, it is the Community State Bank. They've launched a coin buyback program. So basically, for every $100 worth of coins that you can bring them, they'll give you an extra $5. So you could get up to $500 if you've just got a ton of change sitting around. Now is a pretty good time to look for it. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to be able to supply change to their customers, because if you're a business owner, you know, you drop off your deposit at night.
Yeah.
In the morning, you pick up, you know, however many pennies and quarters and all the rolls of coins. Well, they're not able to do that. They're saying that they're giving their customers probably about half or less of what they're looking for. So this is their effort to try to give people the change they need to give to their customers.
It's just really ironic because that's a better rate than they're giving savings accounts, you know, CDs, whatever,
right.
For coins. Yeah. Amy Guth follows the business scene and the coin shortage for us.
That's right. That's right.
We'll visit again next week. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.